This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On today's show, why it pays to teach kids about economics and finance. But first, the archaeologist who made two of the 20th century's most important discoveries about Greek prehistory was a faculty member at the University of Cincinnati from 1927 to 1957. Carl Blagan made discoveries at Troy in Turkey and the Palace of Nestor in Pylos, Greece. Today, UC archaeologists are still making significant discoveries. A team led by UC researchers has been excavating a Bronze Age warrior's tomb, dubbed the Grave of the Griffin Warrior, at the Palace of Nestor. And joining us for an update about the latest findings at the Pylos site and to discuss the life and work of Carl Blagan are directors of the Griffin Warrior Archaeological Project, Dr. Sharon Stocker, University of Cincinnati Department of Classics Senior Research Associate, and UC Classics Department Head and Carl W. Blagan Professor of Greek Archaeology, Dr. Jack Davis. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jack, good to see you this afternoon, and Sharon, thank you for being here. Good to see you.
Thanks, Mark. It's nice to be here.
Indeed.
Jack, who would have known that we had this renowned archaeologist in Cincinnati? I mean, why haven't we heard his story more? Why don't more people know about Carl Blagan and his work?
Well, I think there was a period in time, especially in the 1930s and in the 1950s, when the name of Carl Blagan was really a household name in Cincinnati. And the reason that his reputation was spread so widely at that period was that his chief patrons were members of the Taft family. And the Taft newspapers and media outlets covered absolutely everything that he did. After the death of his principal sponsors in 1960, it all went downhill very quickly.
Mm. Tell us about the discovery that he made at Troy and the discovery that he made at Pylos and the significance of those.
Yeah, well, that was the Troy excavations were the principal excavations that were sponsored by the Taft family. And this all really started in about 1919, 1920, when a group of Cincinnati businessmen, a number of them Tafts, went to Greece. And they were interested in bringing more culture to Cincinnati. So they met with various archaeologists who were living in Greece at the time. Carl Blagan was one of them, and they took a liking to him, and they decided to sponsor his work. Blagan had some problems, logistical and professional problems in the late 1920s when his best friend, who was director of a research institute called the American School of Classical Studies at Athens, got into trouble with his boss and got fired. And this was Blagan's best friend. Blagan was extremely upset about it. So Blagan was working for this same school. He resigned, and he negotiated with his patrons in Cincinnati in order to bring him here to the university. So he came here in 1927 for the first time after some really hard negotiations. We can all learn about negotiating tactics from him. He just said what he wanted. He wanted to be in Cincinnati for one term a year. And he wanted to spend the rest of the year in Greece to carry out archaeological investigations. The university said they'd never heard of such an arrangement. And he said, fine, then I won't come. They gave in.
But if I understand correctly, it was political fallout that actually landed Carl Blagan at UC?
It was political fallout that landed Blagan, much to our great fortune. It brought him to Cincinnati. And on the other hand, there were repercussions of this. One was that He was declared almost a persona non grata in Greece for a period of time in the American community. So once he was here, had to find something for him to do. And the head of the classics department at UC had been studied in Germany, in Halle, in the former East Germany, which was an interesting program that emphasized language, history, and archaeology. And his name was Semple. He was married to a Taft, and he wanted to create a program at UC that aped the German model. But he was particularly a Germanophile, and he was also a good friend of a guy named Wilhelm Dirpfeld, who had been Heinrich Schliemann's assistant in the first Troy excavations. So they cooked up the idea of going back to Troy and clarifying issues that had been left hanging through Schliemann's more cowboy-style excavations in the late 19th century. Schliemann was dead by now. Blagan launched this expedition with a number of Cincinnati graduate students, published them fully, and resolved a lot of the outstanding issues, such as which level on Troy, in the Mound of Troy, was likely to have been the level associated with the legendary Trojan War.
And, this is the Troy that Homer wrote about in the Odyssey.
Exactly. Okay. And of course, that's why those in the classics department at the time thought this was a very relevant thing for classics departments to do. They thought they were excavating actual monuments that had existed in the time of Homer.
Sharon, what's your perspective on Carl Blagan? What are your thoughts on him?
Well, I think he's one of the most famous archaeologists, certainly American archaeologists, that ever lived. And he was instrumental in defining how we think about the Bronze Age on mainland Greece. And he worked at a number of sites in addition to Troy. He came to Pylos in 1929, and he looked for the Palace of Nestor, but he didn't actually excavate. And he left, and then he went to Troy. And so in 1939, he was finally ready to come back and begin his excavation at the Palace of Nestor. And he was very successful there on his first day in his first season. But unfortunately, 1939 was not a good year to begin an excavation in Greece. And so because of World War II and the ensuing civil war, he needed to wait until 1952 before he could begin in earnest. And he worked there for the next 20 years, actually, until his death in 1972.
The reason he didn't begin in 1929 was, again, political. He didn't have the influence, the political influence he needed. So he had to sit for 10 years and wait for his chief political enemy to retire before he could actually go back and put spade in the ground and discover what he knew was there, what's turned out to be the best preserved palace of the what we call the Mycenaean civilization on the Greek mainland.
Who knew there was so much politics in archaeology?
Seriously.
It's archaeology is all politics.
Always there.
Now, what in terms of lesser known things about Carl Blagan, what are some of the things that people might not know about him? Some of the lesser known facts about him, Jack.
Lesser known facts about Carl Blagan. Well, one thing that I suppose not many people know is that he was really quite quiet and retiring. We've talked to people who worked with him. I didn't know him personally. I came to UC in 1972. He died in 1971. And Sherry's at least 30 years younger than I am. Flattery.
We'll get you everywhere. That, didn't you?
But where was I here?
Also, interestingly, he only had one arm. And so his right arm, he actually himself shot it off in a hunting accident in a boat. And so this makes his notebooks very, very difficult to read because he learned to write with his left hand after that, but he was never very skilled at it.
His father was his parents were Norwegian immigrants, and the name was originally spelled with a K instead of a G. Blagan himself said about how to pronounce his name when he was asked that it rhymed with Blagan rhymed with pagan. His father was a Lutheran minister. He preached a Lutheran ministry in Deadwood, which is in South Dakota. It's in the Dakotas, in any case, before they became a state.
Yeah, I'm not sure which, but yeah,
they made a TV show about called Deadwood. It was a pretty wild and woolly place. But later on, his father was concerned with Lutheran ministry in Minneapolis. Blagan himself had a Norwegian accent, and they spoke Norwegian at home. Something else I suppose people don't know about Blagan is that I mentioned his best friend before. His best friend's name was Bert Hodge Hill. Bert Hodge Hill and his wife lived together with Blagan and his wife in a really nice mansion in the center of Athens, which still exists. And they spent their entire life there together, living in the same house. And they were just fantastic friends, all of them archaeologists. But fortunately for us, they were great pack rats. It seems as if they never threw away a thing. And they had—they swore among themselves that the last one to die would leave the house and all of the contents to the American School of Classical Studies at Athens, where it all ended up in the archives and has provided wonderfully rich source material for his biography, which I was involved in a collaboration several years ago in writing a book about Carl Blagan. His life.
And didn't he have a charitable humanitarian side too, Sharon?
Absolutely. Yeah. And he was very involved in the Red Cross during the Balkan War and in protecting the minority populations up there. And so he was just a wonderful man. He loved Greece. They say that in the villages where he worked, he knew the name of everybody's children, and he always greeted people by name. So he was certainly a well-loved figure in archaeology, but also just among people who lived in the places where he worked.
And during World War II, he was too old to send into the field, but he joined the OSS, and he was based in Washington.
OSS, that was what, the Office of Strategic Services?
Yeah, predecessor to the CYA, or to the CYA, to the CIA, CYA something else. His students, though, went actively into the field. My professor, Jack Caskey, was a student of Blagan's, was based in Western Turkey. And another of his classmates was based in Istanbul, and they would send shipments of gold bullion down from Istanbul so that my professor could buy munitions and turn over the munitions to the Greeks' resistance forces that were resisting the Nazis in Greece. And they were organizing rescue missions for Jews once it became clear that the Jews were being exterminated in Greece. Blagan was also was cultural attaché at the U.S. Embassy after the war. He was involved in starting the Fulbright program in Greece, and he was involved in setting up the Marshall Plan in Greece to promote the reconstruction of the country.
Where do you find time to do all this? That's just that's amazing.
He was an incredible man, absolutely.
He really was. Well, remember he made that deal with UC that he was only here for part of the year.
We will continue our conversation, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the Griffin Warrior, the grave of the Griffin Warrior at the Palace of Nestor. And you can join us with your questions and comments at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and my guests this afternoon are the directors of the Griffin Warrior Archaeological Project, Dr. Sharon Stocker, University of Cincinnati Department of Classics Senior Research Associate, and UC Classics Department Head and Carl W. Blagan Professor of Greek Archaeology, Dr. Jack Davis. You can join us with your questions at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Sharon, take us back and tell us how the Griffin Warrior Project got started. How did this particular discovery come to be in the first place?
Well, discovering the Griffin Warrior was actually plan B for us. And sometimes plan A is not always the way that people should go. So we had hoped to excavate in a particular field near the Palace of Nestor in 2015 when we began, and we weren't able to do that. So at the last minute, we needed to come up with an alternative excavation strategy since we had 40 people arriving in a week. And so we worked on some property that is currently owned by the Greek Ministry of Culture. And we developed a sampling strategy, and on the first day of excavation, some of our students noticed that there were four stones visible on the surface of the earth that made approximately a corner. And they said, well, why don't we put a test trench here? And we did. And 10 days later, they came down on the first pieces of bronze, and we knew at that point that we had an unlooted grave that dates to approximately 3,500 years before Christ, which is amazing.
How often is it that you find a grave that's not been looted yet? I mean, is that pretty unusual?
Almost never, especially at these days in Greece, because looting is a huge problem. And also, material was looted in antiquity, in the Mycenaean period itself. So it's very rare to find something that has not been tampered with sometime in the past, either the recent past or the distant past. We were very, very surprised to find this, and it was not part of our initial research design, and it's a wonderful discovery.
Now, when we're talking about the Bronze Age, what period of time is that?
The Bronze Age is about 3000 BC until about 1100 BC approximately. But this particular find dates to about 1450 BC, so it's right in the middle of the period that we call the Bronze Age. It's at the beginning of the time of Mycenaean civilization. The closest parallel to this grave, I think we've said, and the Greek Ministry of Culture has said that there's no grave of similar wealth that's been discovered since the 1950s. And I think that's probably true. But the closest parallel to this grave is one that was found at the end of the 19th century. So we're really talking about a period of 140 years since something so significant and so similar to this discovery was made.
And so spectacular.
And it really is spectacular. One of the things, I mean, we still don't know how many objects are from this grave because Sherry lives in Greece more or less full time. And she's been the one that's been responsible for overseeing conservation, but also for cataloging all the objects. But it's such a labor-intensive job. We don't know how many of the individual pieces of things we have fit together to form holes. We have about 3,000 individual cataloged objects. So we're talking about the number of objects placed in the grave along with this guy, number in the thousands.
How do you know you're not missing something of value? I mean, some of these things that you're digging up, they look like they could just be pieces of dirt or rocks. So how do you know that you've come across something that might be valuable?
That's a good question, Mark. And we save everything. We did save everything that came out of the grave so that we could be sure about what we had. So we saved all of the earth, and we were able to put it through a water sieve so that we could find even the teeniest beads, because some of the carnelian beads are incredibly small. And we also have a sword that has a gold handle that is composed of pieces that are just barely visible with the naked eye. So by putting this through water, we've been able to save every single object that was actually put into the grave. So we're sure that we have everything of value. The problem is that we have many, many, many pieces of bronze. And as Jack said, we're not sure what these bronze pieces go to, but we know that we have a complete set of armor in there. It's just in about 10,000 pieces. So that's one of our big problems right now.
Wow.
My professor told me I wasn't allowed to use the word dirt. We have to earth sounds better. Dirt is something that you wipe off.
So talk a little bit more about the challenges that you faced in doing this excavation.
Well, one of the big problems with the conservation of bronze is that it's very heavily corroded. And so we're not sure what the surface looks like under the corrosion or how thick the corrosion itself is. And when one is cleaning it, one needs to be careful not to damage the original surface such as it is, because if there's decoration or writing there, it could be destroyed. So to help this, we have recently purchased an X-ray machine, which is very exciting, and it will allow us to examine the surface before the conservation process begins. In this way, we've been able to identify various pieces of armor to see where they belong on the body and to locate decoration that we didn't know existed because we couldn't see it. So the big problem is getting the conservators in there to actually do the work. It's a very, very slow process. It's very painstaking, and it requires somebody with a great deal of skill. And we've had a number of conservators come and look at it, and most people are almost afraid to start because it is such an important find. And today, we're able to do so many things that people in the past couldn't do. We've located remains of cloth, which never exist in Greece because of the moisture in the soil. And we've located evidence of padding inside the armor. People have speculated that it existed, but we actually have evidence of it. So it's all slowing down our process, but it's very exciting as we move forward and make these new discoveries.
And we have a colleague in Athens named Takis Karkanas, and Takis is what's called a micromorphologist. So what he does is cut sections of earth out the side of our trench, and he takes pieces of that, which he impregnates with a resin, and mounts them on microscope slides. So he has a whole series of microscope slides from the top of the grave to the bottom of the grave, which he then examines under a very high-power microscope. And one thing that he's discovered is he's actually located traces of the bodily fluids from the decomposition of the warrior buried in the grave. This is a first. We also have we're now proceeding to a stage which we are taking samples for DNA analysis in collaboration with a team based in Harvard. We have these little inner ear bones, things they call a Petrus bone, which is giving the greatest success to those researchers who are involved in the analysis of human DNA these days.
Of ancient DNA.
Ancient human DNA, yeah.
Who are the items that you've discovered? Who do they belong to? Are they property of Greece or?
Everything that you find in Greece is property of the Ministry of Culture. So we ask permission for all of the samples that we take, and everything that we do it with their cooperation. And we're fortunate to have a wonderful collaboration with the people who supervise our work.
Now, the latest discovery is what? It's called a seal stone, I think is the term for it.
It's called a seal stone, yes.
What is this, Sharon?
It's something that was used probably to impress clay or wax. And so in Minoan Crete, which is near the mainland of Greece, it was used perhaps to signify ownership. But it's a tiny stone that has a decoration carved on the surface. So most of them are individual, and you would be able to recognize your seal stone as opposed to someone else's. There are bulls and lions and various types of iconography on the surface. So we found one in this grave that is literally the best seal stone that has ever been discovered, and there are about 60,000 that are known. And this is about an inch and a half long, and it has a very, very complex scene of warfare on it. We call it the Pylos Combat Agate because it shows two warriors who are battling over the body of a fallen warrior. And the person who is winning, the victor we call him, is in a heroic stance. He's striding forward. He's naked except for a loincloth, and he is plunging his sword into the collarbone of his opponent. And clearly he's about to win the day. And so the detail on it is absolutely exquisite. It's amazing if you can see it. And it was published in the New York Times. They ran an article about it in November, and we have recently done a scholarly publication that should be out any day now.
And this is on something that's an inch and a half in size. I mean, yeah. How were they able to get such fine detail onto something so small?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about this on the internet, and people imagine that they had to have had magnifying glasses of some sort, crystal magnifying glasses. We've been talking to expert gem cutters who deny that this would have been possible.
Or necessary to have.
Or necessary to do it. In addition, there's no evidence for such magnification from the archaeological record. Indeed, when gem cutters are cutting gemstones, they don't actually even see the surface of the stone that they're cutting because they use abrasives to cut into hard. This is a very hard stone. It's a six. There's a hardness scale called the Mohs hardness scale. It goes from 0 to 10. This is a 6 on the Mohs hardness scale. It's very, very, very hard. It's an agate.
So most of it would have been done by feel, actually. And one proposal has been that they started with a larger model so that they could see all of the detail and understand the proportions of things and work from the larger model then to smaller and smaller and smaller models. So by the time they got to the seal stone, they really understood the strokes that would be necessary to make this very, very detailed design.
Yeah, another thing that's so extraordinary about this is it is the complicated composition, and there is microscopic detail that's unparalleled. But the other aspect that's unparalleled is the enormous attention that the artist gave to the human anatomy. We have the warrior, the hero that Sherry mentioned, has six-pack abs. These are carefully delineated. There are positions. The fallen warrior on the ground is shown from a back view, and the back of his head. These are experiments in the representation of the human form that we don't find again for about 1,000 years. The closest parallels here are date to about 500 BC in the period we call archaic Greek art. Almost everyone who's seen this has said, if this just appeared on the art market, we would have said it was a fake. It's not. And there are still people.
It sounds like it's too good to be true.
It is too good to be true.
And there are people on the internet who are still claiming that it was a fake, that somehow we slipped it into the grave.
That we should have so much money and so much skill.
Well, if you see the before and after pictures, though, when it was originally put out of the ground, it's a mess.
It is.
It had to
correct.
Be. How long did it take to clean it up?
It took about 2 weeks of really, really careful work. And that's because there was lime incrustation on the face that was decorated. And that's why we didn't realize immediately what it was. But the time really has been in photographing and drawing this seal stone because of the detail involved. And because it's a curved surface, the photographer needed to play with different types of light and then to stitch together a number of photographs to be able to get a good representation of it. The agate itself makes it difficult to see the incision because it's banded brown and white. And so when you just look at it with the naked eye, it's almost difficult to make out all of the detail. And so one wonders how it was meant to be viewed and who was meant to view it, actually.
So we really owe, we have an enormous debt to our photographer, Jeff Vanderpool, for this. And
our artist,
Tina Ross, who's Canadian, she went through a number of revisions of the drawing that's been published, getting feedback from us. But I think we learned as much from her as she learned from us in the execution.
How much longer is the work going to be going on the site?
It's going to be going on long after we're no longer here. I mean, we have the grave, because of the challenging condition of the bronze, is going to take many, many years to conserve and to reassemble.
This is discouraging me from retiring. We have another two summers on our existing permit to continue to excavate. And Sherry mentioned that this was our plan B. After 12 years, the reason we could not activate our plan A was that we had not completed legal expropriation of a field that we wanted to dig in. It has now been expropriated. So after 3 years, we're going to be able to go back to
– So that means you've got the clearance now
to plan
go
A.
In,
to,
go in.
Yep, to
yeah.
go back to plan A,
yeah,
exactly.
We bought the field, so now we can go in there and excavate.
Well, Jack and Sharon, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Mark.
It's been great to be here. Thank you, Mark.
The directors of the Griffin Warrior Archaeological Project, Dr. Sharon Stocker, University of Cincinnati Department of Classics Senior Research Associate, and UC Classics Department Head and Carl W. Blagan Professor of Greek Archaeology, Dr. Jack Davis. If you'd like to take a look at the before and after pictures of the seal stone, there's a link where you can do that at wvxu.org.